Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We have on with us today, and right now I am sending her, both of them actually, another link to come on to the show. Apparently, they did not receive the first one. If everyone will just be patient so that we can get them on the show with us. Okay, audience, I had a problem with Veronique. She just got the email, the link to come on, and Noah is on with us now. So I'd like to let everyone know, today I want to introduce once again Veronique Aitia and Director of Social Impact Rescaled. And as many of you may remember, Veronique was previously a guest on our show talking about the unique detention house they operate in the Netherlands. Also on with us with Veronique is another special guest, and her name is Noah Shoshan, and they can pronounce their names better when I introduce them. Noah is a young criminologist from Brussels, Belgium. Her interests are in penology, European policy, and comparison of cultures and contexts that influence the criminal justice system in different countries. With Rescale, the European movement for detention houses, Noah is committed to submitting the use of detention houses instead of large prison institutions and bringing together actors from across Europe to effect meaningful change. So without further ado, please welcome our guests, Veronique and Noah. And Noah, I'm going to start with you because, first of all, I want you to pronounce your name correctly in the event I messed up. And then we'll have Veronique also come on.
All right. I hope you can hear me well. My name was just right. So Noah Shoshan, people pronounce it differently depending on their language, but that was perfectly fine.
Okay, thank you.
It's really nice to be here.
Thank you so much, Noah, and it's an honor to have you, really. I'm going to introduce Veronique, and then we're going to get started into the show, okay?
Great.
Veronique, do you want to once again introduce yourself and let me know again if I pronounced it right, which I don't think I did. But please introduce yourself as well.
I'm Veronique Aisha, and I agree with Noah. Everyone can pronounce it in their own ways depending on the language. I work for Rescaled and happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Veronique, and I want to thank you also for introducing us to Noah. She has a very interesting career, and she's going to be discussing it with the audience, but I want to thank you for introducing her to us and actually having her come on the show with you. Noah, I really appreciate you taking the time with Veronique to come on, and I want to start off by asking you to please explain to the audience your career as a criminologist, what a criminologist actually does, and how you and Veronique came to be together, because I notice you're both doing similar work, working with the system and trying to find solutions as well as finding the need to have these people incarcerated in the first place, those who are and not wrongfully convicted. But if you can, just explain to the audience a little bit about the work that you do.
Yeah, definitely. So I haven't had that long of a career, as I'm turning 24 this year. And so I studied criminology, and what really drew me to criminology was the coming together of all the different disciplines. I mean, there's politics, there's law, there's sociology, there's psychology, there's so much to take into account. And I've always been interested, or I guess I would say I've always been value-driven. So from the start, I have this idea of I definitely want to work with the prison system or that particularly, but there's different kind of fields within criminology that really interest me, but that kind of share the same values of building a community and inclusivity. And so what a criminologist does is also very broad. So there's so many different directions that you can go into. I have a fellow criminologist who, for example, work in the police system. There's people who work against the police system or try to reform the system, change them. There's people working with young people who have kind of come in touch, for example, with the justice system. But there's also very, I would say, kind of niche categories of criminology which have more to do with kind of city planning and design. You know, how do you make a space feel safe? What does it mean? How do we control public space? Should we control public space? There's lots of ways that a criminologist can find work. So the prison system really is only one of them, but it's mostly about understanding crime, where it comes from, and understanding the reactions to crime. How do we as a society react to crime? What do we even see as crime? How does culture influence that? And how does context influence that? So I'm not sure if I have a straight answer to what does a criminologist do, but for me, it's very much been about taking a step back and not always saying, okay, this is completely right or this is wrong, but more so understanding how did we get to the situation and what influenced that. And that's also how I came in touch with RETAIL, the European Movement for Detention Houses, and Veronique as well, actually when I was still a student of criminology. And I got in touch with them through an internship. And so this way, Veronique and I have actually known each other for a couple of years. And I ended up joining the movement, and it's been really nice working together and seeing the movement grow and experiencing the different people coming in and seeing the developments in Europe, as I'm sure you already discussed a bit in the episode that Veronique was on before. I think is that a bit an answer to your question?
Thank you. And I was going to say, Noah, a criminologist, I know they believe in or they look at the offenders and the reasons why they not so much the reasons why they do it, but the fact is they have an opportunity to make a decision as to whether to do it or not. And I was wondering, do they ever put into any kind of consideration about the individual's mental state at the time of their offenses, or the immaturity of the person, or how does that work with when you're working as a criminologist?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I would say that definitely depends per every country's national context, as it's often a legal framework around that. But in certain cases, let's say in criminal court, they do pay attention to that if they can identify that a person who's living with a mental health disorder, for example, was not in a state to act with clarity. That will be taken into account in, let's say, a criminal court case. But I think that's usually in cases where it's very explicit and it's very clear. But I think in a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of mental health that goes unseen, and there's a lot of different factors that come with that, because it's not only mental health, it's people's living situations, their socioeconomic status, and a lot of things that influence that go largely unseen. And I feel like there's always room for improvement to try and pay more attention to that. But that's definitely what criminology is all about, is kind of taking into account all the different factors and figuring out how that came to be, and then also how can we react to that in a more appropriate way.
You know, one of the things I really admire is the fact that you and Veronique seem to be working together. And her whole concept is detention houses in place of prisons in a way that is really good. I mean, under the exception of, I'm sure, those who are truly, truly violent. But I believe, Veronique, that you had mentioned before that you have larger houses for people like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you mean detention houses and the concept I explained or I told about last time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I invited Noah because I think she's a very humble person, first of all. And I think it's just very important to share the values of Reskilled as well. Like 15 years ago when I started working in this field and trying to change the prison system and trying to work towards a different ideal, I noticed that a lot of people doing the work are older white men. And I think one of the things that I credit Reskilled for is that there are so many young people, women doing this work as well. So I just want to share that in advance. And basically, Noah is working for the European office, and whereas I work a lot in the Netherlands and also trying to find new partners all over Europe, but Noah is very much involved in the European policies. And which we're trying to define at the moment. And we will have like a symposium in March. And I explained a little bit last time, but I think Noah is much more equipped to explain that as well on the European rules for detention houses. So yes, we have smaller scale forms of detention houses or all over Europe. And we identified over 50 of them. Which can be found on the website as well of Reskilled. But the difference is huge. There's no one perfect example, which I mentioned. And I think it's most interesting to see the difference between the houses.
Exactly. Yeah. I want to say in the United States, these are the issues that I find and many others find. And this is one of the reasons why those of you from the across the pond, as Franz Kreis from Germany used to say, those of you who have actually compared the differences between the prisons in your countries compared to the United States, we have mass incarceration in the United States, as I mentioned previously, 2.3 million people incarcerated, men, women, and youth. And this is something that I don't see or hear about, and no one else that I even know of out in the audience or elsewhere know of any other country that has mass incarceration as the U.S. does. And so one of the problems that we have in the country, and right now the presidential campaign runner, one of the campaign recipients that are going for the presidential campaign, Nikki Haley, mentioned on the news the other day, and this is something we've been talking about for years, is that this is a serious issue in the United States of America of mental illnesses that needs to be addressed. And one of the things is that prison, 2.3 million people incarcerated, mass incarceration consists of thousands and thousands of people who have mental, some serious psychological issues, and those who are in for wrongful convictions, and those who were victims before becoming offenders, and those who are first-time offenders. And the United States government now has a mentality of just throwing them all in prison, throwing them in for life without parole, life sentencing, or death penalty. And there's no compassion or no understanding whatsoever about the causes. Now, Mariam Jacobs, I interview, and I said this previously, is from the Netherlands. She is a psychosocial therapist, and she's been in the U.S. prisons, and she has spoken very many times about the problems that we have in this country. In this country, we have a problem with corruption, deception, racism, and vengeance and retaliations. And a lot of times our government leaders, our legislative members, they try to bring out, write bills or compose bills to address life sentencing and life without. They try to get in sync with other countries that have 25-year maximum sentences unless they're serious, serious crimes, terrorism, mass incarceration, or serial killers. And what happens is when they try to do these things and they get bad reviews from people in society or they get complaints, they kind of quiet down and they don't follow through. So they're not really following suit with many of you in your countries who make the decisions and stand by them. And this is what I truly appreciate. Another thing we have, as I say, we have an epidemic of mental illnesses and addictions. And these things are not being addressed where they should be. They're being addressed or trying to be addressed in the prison system. And most people are not getting the rehabilitation that they should be getting in the United States prison system. So these are some of the issues I speak of. Now, in the United States, we have 50 states. And the problem is the same in every state, but every state is run, it's operated differently, which is serious inconsistency. As a social worker, I've worked with families and children throughout my life, and including incarcerated and women of domestic violence and many others. And one of the things I notice, if a home is not consistent in the way it's operated, there's a lot of dysfunction in the homes. And we have that in the United States of America because every state is operated differently. There's so much inconsistency. The problems escalate. Every governor in every state is different. Some have some mindsets that they really don't want to see reform. So they go along with anything and everything, and others don't. So I want to know your thoughts on these things. And I started, as I mentioned to you, Veronique, last time, I started a petition a little over a year ago to end life sentences and to establish appropriate, effective, long-term residential treatment facilities to put these people who have anger management, who have addictions, who have mental illnesses in these long-term residential treatment facilities. And it doesn't mean that they're going to be out in a couple of days or a couple of weeks or a couple of years. They could be in for 20 years. In maximum 25 years. And I believe that would be a lot more successful than the contracted providers they have in the prison systems today. Because these contracted medical providers are not effective. They're not doing the right thing. Many prisoners have been damaged permanently. Many have died because of their works. And if you go on the internet and type in WellPath, WellPath is a contracted medical provider and psychological provider for the Department of Corrections in 37 or 36 states. And they have all kinds of lawsuits pending against them. And their founder is either in prison now or on his way because he's been involved with the courts for bribery and fraud. So I want to know what your thoughts are on this, because many people in this country want to see the United States of America in sync with other countries. Norway is the role model for the world, and your countries are second in line. People from our country have gone over to Norway to see how they operate so that they can put in place some of the same approaches or strategies. And it's starting to happen slowly but surely. There are changes being made that are similar to what you do, your countries. So if you girls can please tell me what you think about all of these things and tell me if there's any areas that I may be wrong or that may be improved. And we'll start off with, let's start off with you, Noah, because as a criminologist, you've dealt with a lot of people, I'm sure, that have been sent to prison and that, you know, that you have done analysis on or studies on.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely recognize a lot of the things that you just mentioned. And I think what's interesting about that is that you mentioned, you know, the specific context of the U.S. and the mass incarceration. definitely holds true, and that's also why, for example, we at Rescaled, we consciously made the choice to say, okay, we are a European movement for detention houses, because we currently do not have the people or the expertise or just the scope to be able to, you know, push for our concept of a detention house worldwide, because there's just so many cultures and contexts and different systems to take into account. But at the same time, I do think there's also a lot of similarities that we can identify, in the sense that you mentioned there's so many inconsistencies between the different states in the U.S., and that's also something that we are already struggling with, trying to compare different European countries. We're trying to learn from each other and trying to see, in Belgium, they're doing it this way, or in Norway, they're doing it this way. Does that work in the Netherlands, or does that work in Spain, or why doesn't that work? And already there, we're already seeing so many different legal frameworks, so many different, also in a way, cultures or what people are used to, the way that the public reacts to crime, the way that politicians, like you said, you know, they don't want to stand behind their choice because their first priority is usually getting votes, and crime is not a very popular topic. So that's also definitely something that we struggle with. And I think there, what's really important to see is, we speak about countries like Norway, like you mentioned, you know, it's often seen as the role model. To some degree, that is true, because they do have some very good examples. But what we've also seen is that, you know, the Scandinavian countries like Norway said, you know, we're not all that great. We do have our own problems as well. We do have flaws in our system. We do have racism and discrimination in our system, and it doesn't help to romanticize it. So we should reach out to each other and help from each other, but never think that it's a good idea to just take one system from a country and copy it and just paste it into the context of a different country, because within criminology also, or comparative criminology, we see that that doesn't work, because every country and every people has its own unique characteristics. And so for a system like that to be able to work, you need to see, okay, how are the people living? What are the narratives that, you know, what drives people, what are the specific problems that we see in an area? And so that's what we've been trying to do in Europe, is getting people in touch, really building a network, building a movement, and learning from each other and seeing, okay, where do we identify similarities, where do we identify differences in our criminal justice system, and how can we learn from each other without making the mistake of just copying a system and hoping it'll work, but really actually taking, I would almost say, 10 steps back and saying, okay, how did we even get here? Why is our prison system overloaded? You know, so many European countries are dealing with severe overcrowding and bad material living conditions. I myself am from Belgium, and we've had so many prisons where there were incarcerated people, you know, sleeping on the floors, on mattresses, in between other beds, on very small cells, and being in the cells 23 out of 24 hours, not having access to any restrooms and things like that. And I think while we do have some very good examples, like the ones that we've mapped, there's also a lot of work to be done. And I think I can recognize what you're saying of, you know, how do we even start, or who do we talk to? And I think the core for us is to recognize that prisons reproduce the social inequalities that we have in society. And so to tackle whatever's going wrong with the prison system at parallel, we also need to tackle, you know, what's going on in society, because you could design the most ideal prison and have all the incarcerated people do all the work and do therapy and, you know, get them education and everything. But it wouldn't matter if that person comes back into society and the society is not ready to welcome them, and the society is not there to see them as a fellow human being, and to be their neighbor, to be their coworker, to be their partner, for example. So that's one really important value to me, is that we address the rest of society and show them that it's their responsibility as well, and that together, that's actually the way that we can try and find, or I would say, co-create solutions, and not just put it all on the shoulders of the prison system, incarcerated people, or even the staff, because they too are, I think, tasked with an almost impossible task of just fixing so many problems that actually just originate from the society that we've built.
I want to thank you because you mentioned something that's very important, and I say this all the time, getting to know cultures. People do not understand cultures, many, many people, because if they understood cultures, I'm sure there wouldn't be even wars going on the way they're going. But you mentioned a lot of these things that you mentioned go right back to cultures, because there are different cultures even in an independent home, even in a family home. There's different cultures. There's no two people alike in under one roof. And so when we talk about getting to know people and know about them, we're talking about a lack of knowledge when it comes to cultures, whether it be in the individual's home, the immediate families, whether it be extended, whether it be in the communities, in the states, in the countries, around the world. We have no knowledge. Many people don't even try to learn about the cultures of others. And I'm sure that even with the United States right now, with the immigration issues, as you mentioned, we have a serious immigration issue in the United States. But one of the things that I noticed, if they understood cultures, rather than putting all this money into walls, into trying to keep these people out, put this money into their government and into oversight of the government. And so these people that are trying to escape poverty or escape violence can remain in their countries knowing that they're going to be safe and knowing that there's all kinds of programs out there for them. We have the same thing in the penal system. Had it not been for advocates, Veronique, opening detention houses or opening supportive aftercare resources or opening some sort of place for these people to go when they come out or even prior to going in, because prevention is the most important thing of all. I had volunteers come into my organization that will take it. They were criminal justice students. They wanted to be police officers, but some of them actually decided not to because they saw where the problem was. And it's not with these people being hardcore criminals. It was a situation where these people were in need of help. If we, instead of sending all kinds of weapons over and monies over to other countries for war, and we spent that money to try to negotiate, since the United States is supposed to be, or was at one time, the true leader of all countries, which is turning around quite rapidly, because the United States of America right now, the people are furious because their own country is becoming a third world country slowly but surely. But cultures is very important. And I think we need to look at this when we look at every situation, especially, as you mentioned, getting to know what the individuals are about or what the community is about, members of society, you know, what their thoughts are, what their deeds are. And people need to be encouraged to get to know the cultures of other people, because people in other countries, they discipline differently. You know, their upbringing is different. And the United States is so, right now, it's so flexible. You know, what used to be not tolerated is now tolerated. You know, just an example, going to church. Years ago, people had really dressed up to go to church. And now people go to church in jeans, women as well. You know, the language that's used, it's a slang. When people say they have a hard time learning English in the United States, we don't speak the proper English. Only the people from England speak the proper English. We speak slang. So we have so much to learn from countries like yours. But the problem is, in the United States, we have a proud country, a proud government that doesn't want to admit that they can learn from other countries. So they do things their way, even though they know their way is not working. And I find this very, very upsetting and disappointing, because we have a lot to learn from countries like yours. And Veronique, I'd like to know your thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, a lot of thoughts run through my head, but I think one of the main things is that with, for example, Reskilled, we're providing an answer to replace prisons, but that doesn't mean that people and countries should look at that as the answer. I think it's always important to first think, like, what is the problem we have? And I think in the U.S., it's very important that they first look into decriminalization and deprivatization. That I think that's one of the key factors I've learned from looking into the Scandinavian policies, that they didn't came up with a new prison. They came up with new social policies. So that preceded a new vision, new ideas on social reform, preceded the change in the penal system. And I think that's the first step, of course, that the U.S. and policymakers in the U.S. need to acknowledge, that they need to reform that instead of thinking about, okay, what type of prison should we build now and should we make it more humane. I don't think that's the best way to go first. I think first they should go look into the decriminalization policies. So that's,
One of the things that happened in the United States is the mental institutions that they had in this country, they ended up closing every single one down in the United States. They closed them all down, and they started putting them in prison instead. And this is sad, because if they reestablished these institutions and they monitored, they had oversight, and they brought in experienced people, medical, psychological, even spiritual advisors or therapists, then they would see a big difference in not only the individuals themselves, but also in the country. And this is something that they have not done. The problem is, again, we have big corporations, large corporations that are making so much money off of incarcerated individuals. They even with the work programs, they pay them less than $1 a day. Others $1 a day. And these big corporations are making hundreds and hundreds of dollars off of the things that these prisoners are making. That is one of the things. I want to also say, with the immigration issues, when they started to deport or send away the parents or the people that were coming through the border, they ended up caging all of them. Then they ended up sending the parents, or they claimed to have sent the parents away, leaving all of these children in the United States in facilities where they don't have their parents with them, where their children that are petrified, where their children that are being violated by the very people who are supposed to be working in the government. These people that have been turned away, I even wonder, did those people get turned away back to their country, or were they killed? Because if that was a parent that was missing their child, they would find a way to get it out in the media, some way to find their children. And what I understand in the United States is that they forgot, or they can't identify whose children are who and who the parents are. This is major, because now these children are in these facilities because they came over illegally with the parents. And there's no way of finding their parents or identifying them to return them to their parents. That's one issue. Another issue, an example, is that there was a prisoner. He's released, but he's released to ICE. He was from El Salvador. He's been in this country since he was 3 years of age with his parents, who live in Boston, Massachusetts. They have been out of El Salvador for over 30 years. This prisoner became a prisoner because he killed the person that had been molesting him, that had been raping him since he was a child, right into his teens. He killed that person, and he went to prison for 15 years. Now that he's being released, they want to deport him to a country he doesn't even know, because he was sent here as a child, as a little baby. And they're going to deport him, which is going to be devastating, to send someone to a country they're not familiar with. That's another example. Another example is a prisoner who was mentally ill several years ago, who was put in a shower by some prison guards, and the water was turned up to 100 degrees. And they let that person scald to death, screaming where everyone on the block could hear him, screaming for his life. And they left it running until every bit of muscle and skin departed, separated from his bones. This is the type of injustices that go on in the American prisons. In Lowell, and this was in Florida, in Lowell Prison in Florida, of all female prison, all of these prisoners, female prisoners, were being raped by correctional officers in their prison. These are some of the issues that I have a problem with and many others around the country have a problem with, because there is no oversight into any of these prisons, no independent oversight. And when investigations are done, it's done internally by their own. I don't know how it works in your countries, but I would like to know how those things work in your country.
No.
And we'll start off with either one of you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, Leona. Just trying to gather my thoughts on everything that you mentioned, as well as the examples, which are very clearly horrifying and just inhumane. I don't think anyone should even be able to argue about that. But this problem of oversight and monitoring you mentioned, I think this is not the only reason, but one of the reasons why these things, you know, are able to be up and just get lost where they aren't monitored, because of a huge level of anonymity in a lot of these, like the penal system, like the prisons. They're such big systems overloaded with bureaucracy, and it's just blending one case from one person to the next. And no one really has an idea what's going on. Prison governors don't necessarily have an idea of what's really going on in the day-to-day in their prison. How could one person, let's say, have an oversight over 800 prisoners, let's say, and neither does the staff. So I think one way that we can be, get back some of that accountability, that people take on accountability and more responsible and having an oversight in what's going on, is by scaling down. That way, you won't have the situation of having a small number of staff taking care of a large number of incarcerated people in prison. But rather, you would have a smaller number of staff taking care of a smaller number of incarcerated people. And they actually have the opportunity to get to know each other, to build relationships. So even though a person of staff might have some authority, in the sense that, of course, they're also have something to say in the security of a prison or the movement that an incarcerated person has in prison, they actually get to know them, and there is a very clear idea of what's happening. The management and the governor, for example, have a very clear idea of who the staff are, who the incarcerated people are. And I think in that scenario, it is much harder to get away with things that aren't right, because everyone can see it. And as if we look at how people behave, we see that as soon as you're in a smaller group, you're less inclined to help someone hide something or to not speak up because you can tell it's not right. Whereas if you're standing in a crowd of a thousand people and someone's doing some wrongdoing, you'll think, okay, you know, someone else will, I'm sure someone else will report that. And so I do think there's great value in rescaling and going down so that we actually have an idea of what's going on, and we can avoid these horrifying stories and kind of reduce that to a way of actually seeing each other as humans, because I think that's also what happens in these really, really big prisons and in this system, is that people forget to talk to each other and forget that they're, you know, that there's a human sitting there with a history, with a feeling, with an emotional, just with a lot of emotions, and it just becomes, you just become a number, and for the staff, it just becomes one more case that they have to tick off, one more person they have to come by, one more task that they have to do, and that's where we see where these kind of weird situations unfold, and where people who
have come to believe that they, you know, have the right to abuse their power. They exercise that in that moment. And I think bringing us back to that humane connection might be a way to help reduce these examples. Maybe Veronique can say more about that as well.
And real quickly, Veronique, before you say anything, I wanted to just say one thing. You mentioned, Noah, you mentioned smaller groups and smaller staff. This is exactly what needs to be done in the U.S. They need to not only break it down so that there's they need to categorize, and I don't know if you do it in your prisons in your country, and Veronique can respond to this, but one of the things I always say is they should put these people in a prison in blocks or wherever according to their ages or the crimes they've committed, put them in according to it's almost like they just clutter them in, regardless of what. There are people in, people serving life that are in with young people that are only in for a few years. They don't put them in there accordingly to the crime or to the, even those that, we have people in prison in the United States that are 80 and 90 years of age in wheelchairs, those with dementia, those with Alzheimer's, those with Parkinson's disease, those that are terminally ill. They just throw them all in together like cattle. This is a major problem. But I wanted, I'm going to ask Veronique to speak, but I wanted to ask both of you also, what are your thoughts on having, say, a yearly coalition meeting between all people involved, like government leaders, all meeting globally, to go over some of these things, to talk about how every country or every situation is operated, so that they can bring back to whatever countries they're going to, they can bring back something that they may have either taught or learned through these meetings. We have governors in every state that make the decision as to whether someone should be released or not, and according to whatever they think. But we also think that if there was a coalition where everyone globally that is in that position met on a yearly basis or every couple of years to go over some of these issues and talk about ways in which they can improve their system. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but Veronique, I want you to respond to what Noah was saying, but if you can also respond to this and tell us your thoughts on some of these things.
Yeah, I'll start with the idea of the coalition. In Europe, we have the CPT. It's the Committee for the Prevention of Torture. They already go to prisons and visit them and to make sure that the human rights standards are abided to. So there are several mechanisms in Europe and on a national and European level that do that work. On an international level, I wouldn't know. Maybe no one knows of an organization that does that or a mechanism that comes together.
That's the problem. There is none. And this is why I was wondering what your thoughts on and Noah's thoughts were on having something like this established, maybe through the United Nations. I don't know. But having something like this established where it can happen on a yearly basis, not immediately to start going into the prisons for oversight, but just to have all these leaders sitting down together and talking about ways in which they do things successfully and how they can pass that on to other countries.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I can add to that. I don't want to speak on this without, you know, with 100% certainty, as this is not something I've looked into systematically, but that international coalition or that meeting that you're talking about, I do feel from my impression of, you know, looking through international resources and documents, I feel like the topics linked to the prison system and to criminal justice are very much talked about, and, you know, there's groups and there's departments for different topics in justice, but the actual group of incarcerated people, of prisoners, is usually, you don't see it written explicitly often in these documents. There's not one group that really addresses this group. So I feel like there's a lot being done around these topics, and a lot of what they do applies to incarcerated people. So the priorities where they say, okay, we need to work on, you know, work on increasing chances on employment, giving people better training, people who are vulnerable to mental health things, and all of that is being worked on. But I feel like sometimes the link is missing to the actual group of people who are in prisons and who are released from prisons. And I feel like that's a group that's just generally very forgotten. And that there, I think, lies the issue, because people don't really want to pinpoint it, like we mentioned. And they forget that the people who are in prison are also these vulnerable groups that they're speaking about. And I think a lot of people try to separate them. They think, you know, someone who's been a victim can't be someone who's in prison, or someone who's just maybe has grew up in poverty. You know, they're not that stereotypical image that they think of when they think of someone in prison. And I think they're really lacking of bridging the gap and seeing the same kind of people that we're talking about. And they should be as important on an international level to explicitly speak about incarcerated people. And I wish for that to happen more often.
Well, I do too. I hope it does, because, you know, the UN actually scolded the United States of America on the prison issues and the things that they're not doing right. And I'm hoping, and this was recently, so I'm hoping that the United Nations will become more involved. But again, the European movement for detention houses is, to me, a really good movement, and it needs to be extended to other countries, mainly right now the United States of America. But the subjects you're talking on really make sense too, and I'm hoping that it will become a more broader issue or resolution to the problems that we're having around the world, but mainly in the United States once again. And Veronique, if you can just give us some feedback, your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the value of having an international platform where we would discuss issues related to country. I think, like the philosopher Hannah Arendt said, like human rights for all is human rights for none, basically saying like we cannot have like these general guidelines, these general rules, and then expect countries or people to implement that, because there are so many ways of how you can interpret one sentence, one word, how you can execute certain policies. And I think that's exactly what we're trying to look into and dive into, like what is the differentiation in between these policies. And I think one of the things that Noah mentioned, the anonymity of prisons and low accountability, low agency, low levels of autonomy. I think that's exactly what we need to address and what we need to do differently. And how to do it is something that I look forward to discussing on a European and even an international platform. Like, how can you do it? So not necessarily the broader issues addressing them, but also how do we want to see the change?
Exactly. Especially, as you mentioned, it's so important to do an international coalition to meet, you know, once a year, to have all the policymakers or whatever, you know, come together and talk about all these things. If they can do it for all other issues, they should be able to do it for the penal system, the prison system, because that's largely, I mean, worldwide. But I also want to just change some things a little bit right now, because I want to go to our former president, Donald Trump, and our current president, Joseph Biden. Now, these are two that right now have been, not so much Biden, his son, though, but these are two people who have been involved in the court so much because of some kind of criminal activity or alleged criminal activity. And they seem to, this has been going on for years, and yet, if it was an average citizen in the country that was being charged with the same offenses, it wouldn't take years as it has taken in our country to resolve these issues. And it's become a thing where it's on the news every single day, almost every single hour, in some stations every single second. And these people have been going back and forth to court. These people have been feeling bad for their loved ones because their loved one, like Joe Biden's wife said, her family's been devastated. You know, it's torn the family apart. The grandchildren are hurting. This is something that happens in every situation. There were so many people, 2.3 million people in prison, but there are thousands whose family are devastated, who are going through the same thing. But yet people focus on their own situation rather than look at the picture, broader picture, where there's something that needs to be done. You know, we can't go on this way. And that's why I'm going back to having a coalition to meet yearly to talk about ways to improve the system, ways to improve the court system as well, and the parole board, the parole system. There's so much that needs to be done. And if it's successful in other countries, and even though you in your country may do things differently and may not see success at all times, you have a reputation that is worldwide respected. Because there's no biases. What you do is you weigh things out. Now, Veronique, the rescale is a movement that's not even close to in the United States. Something like this should be in the United States. And unless people from the United States goes to other countries and sits down and learns about programs like yours, movements like yours, they're not going to consider it. They really won't. So as I say again, there's a lot to be offered if we in our country were to extend ourselves, invite people like yourselves to the United States to speak to the government employees, the legislative members, the president, the vice president, whomever. If they were to invite people like yourselves here, or if they were to agree to start holding an international coalition every year, no changes will happen in the United States, no major changes, and this is a problem. This is a serious problem.
If I could maybe inspire a bit or give some hope, insight, like as a reaction to what you just said, you know, there needs to be move like this and, you know, States and I think from what we experienced with the European movement on detention houses is that there's so many people out there who share these values and are doing great work, but we're just not connected. We don't know of each other. It's not
exactly
same for the United States, because what's important for us is the movement. It doesn't have to be, it's not fully established organizations. Sometimes it's just one individual. Sometimes it's someone's story, and someone like you, for example, is one of those people in the United States sharing these values and is doing that work. And so I think it's about maybe it's about creating the movement, about finding each other, and that's a very hard task to do, definitely. It's definitely, as it's such a large country as well, as is, if you kind of it's hard. You know, for Veronica is doing an amazing job of finding people all over Europe who connect with, but I'd like to be hopeful to think that people, you know, they're out there and exist, but we need to find a way to speak with each other and together form, you know, a much stronger bond, I would say, to address these issues.
Veronique, what your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the work we do is not necessarily based on trying to find the right answer and having the final answer, but is really trying to create a movement, like Noah's saying, and really listening to each other, trying to push forward policies, awareness raising. And all of these things are happening in the U.S. as well. For example, there's this movement, Take Back the Court, because you were mentioning about the importance of the court system and changing that. And I know of an organization, Take Back the Court, and they say, like, we cannot restore American democracy or solve big national challenges like climate change, racial justice, access to affordable health care, and economic inequalities unless we take back the court. And I think also Mass Design Group, who is doing amazing work on the architecture of prisons, but mainly focusing on restorative justice, housing and architecture, so not building new prisons, but building places where you can deprive people of their liberty to some extent, but not the full body as we do it now in the penal system. So I get inspired a lot by organizations in the U.S. So I think it's just focusing on making that connection between each other.
Again, I believe that the monies that are being put into the prisons, I believe should be going into places like yours, you know, detention centers or really housing instead of, I noticed, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I understand that the prisons in your countries are not steel bars, and they're more, a lot of them are more like dormitories. They're more humane, and the programs are more, the rehabilitation, the educational programs, they're a lot more accessible and appropriate for the people that are incarcerated. Is that something that's, you know, that's accurate, or am I maybe misunderstanding some things?
I would say both examples exist. So we do have some really great examples where our infrastructure is sometimes less, typically with the steel bars, as you mentioned. That is true, but then we also do still, you know, so many of our prisons are housing buildings that were built in the 1800s that were inspired by the idea of, for example, very famous model, the Panopticon model of having constant surveillance over the incarcerated people at all times. And so that's the way these buildings were built, and they were all individual cells. It's all rooms where these very tiny cells, there's no spaces to actually speak with each other. So a lot of the incarcerated people in Europe, they, for example, they will receive most of their meals on their cell individually. There's no common area or kind of cafeteria-like place in prisons where, for example, food is served. And as a result of things like overcrowding, you know, people get stuck in these cells a lot. So I would say we have both. We have very... we have examples that correspond more to the stereotypical idea and also correspond to the examples that we have in the U.S. And we also have different ones, and that's because of the inconsistencies that we spoke about earlier as well. Sometimes you have to be lucky to which prison you're going to be transferred to, or you have to be lucky who's governing that prison, because sometimes just having a different management can really influence culture that's in prisons. Maybe Veronique, you can add something to that.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that perfectly. The only thought that comes into my head is a campaign by Adidas, and Noah knows I'm a fan of it, because what they did, they said, like, we created one shoe, but then you created 1,000. And I think that's the whole idea, that there is no one perfect example, and like Noah said already, like, both examples exist. And I think at the end, I hope to see if there are like 1,000 houses, that there are 1,000, they are all different. And I think we need to keep that in mind and not see detention houses as a new prison that we should export, because that is what we have done in the past centuries, export a model, and like that is the only way to deal with crime or to deprive people of their liberty in that way. They used to do it by sending people away from the city, and that they were basically left on their own. And then the prison paradigm came up, and I think it's time for a new model, but it's not one type of house that we try to implement or advocate for.
I will say, years ago, in the United States, and I guess it's still going on, I'm not sure, but for people that were in gangs, gang members, they had a place, a secret place, that they would send those gang members that wanted to get out of the gangs, that wanted to disassociate themselves with the gangs. They had a place that they were sending them to in one of the states in the United States. And I find that's another interesting strategy. And I think that should be explored more, too, from our government to try to work with these people that are trying to get out of gangs. But I wanted to mention this, too. We have a very high rate of suicides in the prisons throughout the country and alleged suicides. And this is, to me, this is a clear example of people that have psychological issues that couldn't cope with the situations that they are in. And if they had that support prior to going to prison, maybe they would not have been committing suicide. So these are other issues that I find very important to bring out, because a lot of people are targeted in the prisons, not only by other prisoners, but also by staff, by prison officials. I know of one case where a prisoner has been trying since being in, and that prison has been in almost 30 years now, that has been trying to get involved in programs, because when they do go up for parole, if they have nothing to show for the years they've been in, they don't get it. They don't get parole. They don't even get considered. So this is one way our penal system operates in a lot of areas where prisoners are being deprived of participating in anything that's going to make them look good. And when that time comes, they don't have an opportunity to even file for release because they don't have anything to show. Another thing, again, like I say, with the medical providers, many of the prisoners have been permanently damaged, and some have been even died from ineffective treatment. So all of these things together need to be addressed. And I go right back to these yearly meetings, coalitions, and detention houses. I know, as you mentioned, Veronique, that it shouldn't be the only consideration, for the housing or whatever. But at the same time, it's a good movement. It's a start, and more people, more countries, more government leaders should focus on opening either more detention centers, houses, or opening, mental institutions again. Reestablishing them, but having oversight and monitor each and every one of them on a yearly basis. We have so many nonprofits. We have so many organizations that don't have any monitoring. The penal system, again, they don't have monitoring. They have their own independent, but they need, their own internal, but they need independent monitors, overseers, to make sure, to ensure that everything is being done on a upscale level, on a legal and humane level. We're talking about human rights. We have a lot of human rights organizations that are not even coming close to the penal system to check out, to make sure these people are being treated right. We have Department of Mental Health in the United States that don't want to get involved with prisoners, yet they're the ones, if they were there for these people when they try to get help prior to them going in, they would probably not be in prison. We have the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association that get all this money, all these fundings for research, when we already know what the problem is, put that money into trying to treat these people. The United States of America is about, it's about fame. It's about media attention. It's about all of these things. And I reached out to a CNN reporter once about the possibility of having some of the people from the Netherlands as well as the United States, including lawyers and psychologists, to go on the show to talk about the issues of mental health and to talk about these issues that are occurring in the prisons. But yet, unless it's somebody that's already established themselves as someone in power in the United States, they don't want to look at anyone from other countries that they're not familiar with, which is a big mistake, because there's people that already know what the problems are in their countries and how to resolve it, that can do something positive in the United States. This is the time to do it. Nikki Haley, a presidential candidate, spoke about the mental health issues. We have people from the Netherlands, from Brazil, Brussels and Belgium and all these places, Amsterdam, that are willing to come on the show and talk about some of these things. And yet, unless they're known in the United States, or they have these popular books out there that they're promoting, we have a news media and a government that doesn't even want to take a look at these things. And this is why we have such a major problem in this country. It's frustrating. It's frustrating, but it's listening to you, Noah, listening to you, Veronique, listening to Franz Dow, a 27-year former veteran, warden, and listening to, others that have come on the show that are trying to look at Frank DeBrine. He's doing his workshops with those coming out. There's so many that have so much to offer. And this is why we're not successful, because our country is too proud of a country to try to explore and listen to and interview people like yourselves. And unfortunately, this is why we have ongoing problems in this country. It's sad, but this is what's happening.
Do you see a positive movement as well in the U.S. in some areas?
Yes, I understand. I don't. I think one of them was North Dakota. I don't understand or really know which ones, but there are, and advocates have been really excited about it because a couple of them told me, Leona, they're starting to look at, following suit with what's going on over in other countries, in the Netherlands. They're starting to look at some of these things. And Governor Shapiro from Pennsylvania did away with the death penalty. Some of these other countries are starting to look at some of these these aftercare resources, improving them and making them more accessible to those coming out. But they say they're starting to actually follow suit in some of the things that you have and others have been talking about on the show. So I'm hoping that through these interviews and through what's going on in other countries, through the government leaders and people that are going over to Norway, that maybe they'll start doing it on a more broader area. But unfortunately, as I say, in the United States, every state is run differently. Every state is run by a different governor. And some governors, I believe, are open to change. And other governors are open to more harsh sentencing and treatment. We have a governor in Texas. His name is Governor Greg Abbott. This man has not only maintained the death penalty, but he has been the state that has executed the most people incarcerated. He also has been talking about these immigrants coming over. He and Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida actually lured some immigrants into this country and sent them up to the northern part of the country, Massachusetts and New York and other states, to prove their point. They wanted to show the Democrats, since they weren't doing enough to stop the immigrants from coming here, that this is what you can deal with. And right now, I believe there's some lawsuits against some of them. A couple of these people. I don't know if it'll go through. But this is what we have in this country. We have so much division, and we have two governors that seem to be the worst in making change, positive changes. But yet there are some states that are following suit or trying to follow suit slowly but surely with your countries.
Hmm.
So we'll see what happens with that.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think also it's the people you just mentioned, Greg Abbott, I believe, and Ron DeSantis, if you look at who these people are who are making these policies and making these statements. We see again that there's just too many people in power who are
you know, overprivileged and benefit from white supremacy. And there's so many, I mean, men who are reaching the age of 70s and 80s. And it's like, how can you even understand the people who are being born into this world, and the young men, for example, who, you know, who end up going through the criminal justice system and end up in prison? You don't speak for them, and we have to empower the voices of people of color, of people with, you know, different backgrounds, with different religions. And I think, you know, if we're able to put more of these people in positions of power, you know, they may have a chance of together, like, electing them to these higher positions. Because men like these, they're just holding it back, honestly, and they're just following these century-old systems, which are, you know, ingrained with inequality and discrimination and racism. And I think that's why also these conversations, like now, you know, the show that you have and these small spaces, that's the spaces that inspire me. In the traditional media, like you mentioned, it's really hard to break through, but there's so many nice initiatives, so many, you know, articles and podcasts and shows like yours, where people are just talking to each other and sharing their experiences. And that's the places that really inspire me, and it's our hope that we can find a way to mainstream them and to bring them closer to the general public, because I do believe that that's where the real drive for change lies, within the smaller communities, within the people who have experienced things, within the people who understand how complex it is to address these issues and all the inequalities that we need to pay attention to. So also just wanted to just say thank you for doing this show and getting all these people on here to talk. I think it's a really, really great thing. It's very cool to be here.
What we lack in the United States is, you just mentioned some of these things, age and everything else. As far as our president and our former president, yes, they are up there in age. And this has been talked about by, you know, the runner-ups. But one of the things is, and you just mentioned some things that really make sense. And we lack, in this country, people don't communicate. They don't question. They don't ask questions. If they hear something about someone or something, they just automatically assume it's true. They don't ask questions. I'm the type of person, I'll ask all kinds of questions, because unless we ask questions, we're not going to know. We have a media that reports one-sided stories. Now, they will go all the way over to Ukraine and Russia, Israel, Gaza, all these places to get into the news, but they can't go into their own prisons in the United States to get, you know, to get another side of story. So what happens is, the media is reporting one-sided stories. And this is putting the fear into people in the United States, because they're only hearing the one side. They're not hearing both sides to every story. And sometimes there's three sides. But asking questions, communicating, is so important. We don't have people communicating as they should. You know, this show, after this show is over, I will go on Facebook. I belong to 42 different groups and advocacy groups and prison groups. I will go on there, and everyone will have liked what you and Veronique have been talking about. Everyone will have checked that like, but they don't share, and they don't come on to ask questions. They assume, and this is a problem we have in the country. If you don't ask questions, you're not going to get the correct information. Look at Nikki Haley, a legislative, a presidential campaigner, says, and Ron DeSantis, the same thing, said on national television more than once that the United States is not a racist country, when in fact everybody, even from other countries, acknowledges that it is. That's one thing. We have to admit that there's a problem when it comes to advocating for those incarcerated. We have Franz Kurz from Germany, and we have Franz Dahl, and we have Miriam Jacobs, and we have others who have been, and Jan Banning He's not a prisoner advocate. He's a professional photographer. But we have all these people advocating for wrongfully convicted in the United States of America. Franz Kurz from Germany has been advocating for a Shane Crum and a Donald Glenn in Ohio. Jan Banning has been advocating for Christine Boyle in Georgia. And Mariam Jacobs has been advocating for others. There's people advocating for people in the United States that aren't even from the United States. They're from your countries. And if they can take that initiative to do something that people in our own country can't do, that's saying a lot. That's saying a lot for your countries. And the United States is supposed to be the superpower. This is supposed to be the world's leader. And yet other countries are doing the job in the United States that this government cannot even do and will not even try to do to resolve these serious issues of mental illnesses, addictions, overcrowding in the prisons. China, they talk about China all the time, but they've over-exceeded China's mass incarceration, which doesn't say a lot for the United States government. When your people over in your countries are advocating for wrongfully convicted in the United States, that is saying a lot. And if you, all of you, know what's going on in the United States, that says a lot, because you study different cultures. And the United States is a culture. The United States of America is many, many cultures, representatives from every country in the entire world. I have a girlfriend, Carla, who is also from the Netherlands, Carla Humbert. And she still speaks the language. She's been in this country for years and years and years. She also is a social worker and a teacher. But our government is too settled in with they're too content with the way things are, unless it affects them. Recently, a couple of years ago, they legalized marijuana. Most likely because either they or their children are probably doing marijuana, but there's people in prison who have been in prison for years because of marijuana, and they're still sitting in prison even though it's been legalized. There's a wrongfully convicted individual, Christopher Dunn, who has been in prison since he was a teenager. But if you go on the internet and type in Christopher Dunn, D-U-N-N, you're going to see a judge dismissed his case years ago. But he's a young prisoner of color. Well, he's not young anymore. He's in his 40s. But he's been in prison for over 25, 30 years, even though his case has been dismissed. So this is why I say there's such inequality, not only in this country, but ignorance of this country, that they can benefit from listening to professionals like yourself and Veronique and others like you. And I just admire that. But I wanted to ask you, if you want to give the audience, both of you, if you want to give the audience any of your information, how they can contact you, or if there's anything you'd like to have them know or if you'd like to say to them, please feel free to do it. And Veronique, we'll start with you, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So thank you, first of all, for inviting us, and I really appreciate, and you say you admire us, but I really admire your work and the way, the passion you speak about, and the many examples of the horrific examples you give. And I think it's important to remember why we all want to change the system, because otherwise we will only talk about systemic change without, and then lose our hearts and in into the change. But so thank you. And if people want to know more about the work we do, they can find more information on www.reskills.org, or send us a message online. We're on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook as well. So yeah.
Can you once again tell them exactly what the detention houses are, how they differ, and the type of clientele that they house?
Yeah. So a detention house has three pillars. The concept of a detention house is three pillars, which is small scale, differentiation, and community integration. And each of these pillar in itself is very differentiated, meaning that for youngsters, maybe you would have a detention house of maybe 4 to 6 youngsters. It can be 12 as well. It can range. And for adults, you can have around 15 is what we see a lot. But sometimes even 40, we think that's too much. We say like around 15 people, but it really depends on who is who will be placed in the house. And also it can depend. Some are only for males, some only for women, some are completely mixed, transgender, like every color of the rainbow can be housed. It really depends, again, on the needs of the individual. So the differentiation, pillar number 2, is very important. And community integration. Going back a little bit about to Norway, where Bastøy is often used as an example. Bastøy is an island. It's not small scale. It's not as huge as a prison, of course, but not small scale, and also away from the community. So whereas people might have a nice place to live and can walk around freely, but if they are if they have come back into the community, they again have to rebuild everything. So I think that's where the third pillar from Reskilled comes in, that we want people to stay part of the community and build their lives within that community. So, yeah, that's the 3 pillars.
That's awesome. That really is awesome. And Noah, I wanted to ask you one last question before I ask you to speak out to the audience as well. I understand you're committed to supporting the use of detention houses instead of large prison and institutions. But you also mentioned bringing together actors from across Europe to effect meaningful change. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So that's one of the main things that we do at Reskilled, is bringing together stakeholders from all over Europe, whether that be people who have been involved in the criminal justice system themselves, whether it was policymakers, sometimes it's academics researching the situation in prisons, be people who've previously worked in the system, the other NGOs. So we're really committed to just bringing them together, speaking to each other, learning from each other. I think this year, especially 2024, is going to be a really exciting year, as we're going to be hosting a European conference in March in Brussels, and we're expecting, you know, attendees from at least 27 countries, if not more, European countries. And it's really a great opportunity, and I think quite unique, to be able to bring together to speak about, you know, the prison system, to speak about incarcerated people, and to speak about a systematic change, so not just improving the system, changing the system, and especially bringing people together in one space who usually wouldn't have the chance to meet, who wouldn't speak to each other because they have very different backgrounds. Often, you know, that's the higher levels, they speak to each other, and then this, you know, more civil society speak to each other. But we want the higher level people in power to also speak to the people from the civil society organizations, and we're really excited to be doing more of that this year. And if you follow us, to the audience, if you're interested and you follow our social media, which you can find through our website, I think you'll be able to see, you know, what comes out of that. And we're hopeful that we can drive a bit more awareness and really drive some change on a European scale as well.
And what is the link to the website where they can follow that?
That's www.rescaled.org. So everything you'll be able to find there, as well as our social media platforms. You can find what we regularly post, you know, things happening in different American countries, or blog posts, the kind of opinion pieces or interviews. That could be a great place to follow us.
Okay, this is good. I was going to say, you mentioned your age, and I want to say one thing, Noah. For someone your age to be doing all that you're doing, I have to really give you a lot of credit. Young people today need to get more involved in a lot of these things. And I had a volunteer, his name was Simon Brand. And Simon Brand, he was a political science major who was at the Joe Biden University of Law, Political Science in Baltimore. He's now in Australia doing some of his internship out there. And he, like you, was very young. He's very, very mature, very intelligent, and very motivated. And I just hope and pray that any young people listening to this show today will take something out of this for themselves in listening to you, because you have a lot to offer at a very young age. And I really appreciate you coming on, and I hope that you and Veronique, she says people can pronounce your name, you know, whatever way they wish to, but I would like to be able to pronounce it correctly. But I hope the both of you will be coming back on the show again, because you have a lot, both of you have a lot to offer. And Veronique, I hope that you get the funding that you need to continue with this European movement for detention houses, and that you get enough to even, again, expand, whether it be aftercare, you know, supportive housing, transitional housing, whatever the case may be. Programs like this are good. They're good, and they need to be shared. And we need to, again, I hope and pray that we will see some kind of coalition, international coalition established, where people, our governments, our governors or whatever, can meet on a yearly basis or every couple of years to go over all the issues that involve the prison system. And the criminal justice system is in need of, it's in need of reform. And criminologists like yourself, Noah, I admire what you do, and I haven't seen too many criminologists or heard of too many criminologists or heard of criminologists that, you know, that try to not only do their job, but also try to work with others to make it, make these incarcerations or these consequences a little bit more easier for them when they're serving their sentencing. So I thank you for what you do as well, and I thank you very much for being on
thank
the show
you.
Today.
And thank again, you, Brianna. I appreciate it.
I hope you will both be on. Audience, you've been listening to Noah Shoshan, and you've been listening to Veronique Aicha. Veronique,
yep.
Please help.
Veronique Aicha.
You've been listening to two special, very special guests, and I hope you will join us the next time. If they and when they come on, I hope you'll join us and ask questions, because unless there's communication between individuals throughout the world, there's not going to be a lot of success in certain areas. Don't be afraid to communicate with one another. Don't be afraid to speak out. I look at people that speak out and that communicate as leaders, not followers. And we don't have to be followers, because followers are people that are too afraid to speak out for themselves. So they listen to and take advice from some people that they might not even know is deceptive or lying or whatever the case may be. Be your own leader. Ask questions. Communicate. Open up topics. Talk about the issues that get involved. And again, I thank all of you for listening in. And Noah and Veronique, I thank you for being here. And please let me know if you have the address, email, and also the WhatsApp. Please let me know when and if and when you can come on again. In the meantime, thank you so much once again for everything that you do, for all that you do, and for taking the time to come on the show today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you so much, Leanna.
Thank you both. You're very special. We are now going to end this episode, everyone. Thank you for listening in, and God bless everyone.